The Right Question is funded by the Steele Reese Foundation, by Humanities Montana, and by listeners like you.
What is a fobbit?
A fobbit is a soldier who tends to stay back at the forward operating base, which are called fobs, in the combat zones of Iraq and Afghanistan. And they're generally support soldiers who are trying to avoid combat for whatever reason. Maybe avoid is the wrong term to use, but a lot of these soldiers just don't want to face up to the fact that they're in a combat zone. So they kind of busy themselves with paperwork and office duties and spend most of their tours of duty there in the cubicle jungle. But you also have kind of your reluctant fobbits, and those are usually like the staff officers who really want to be outside the concertina wire in the combat zone, out there leading the soldiers and kicking down doors, as we say. But then they're given a kind of a desk-bound job. And you can identify those guys who are sitting around headquarters grumbling about being stuck back at the fob all day long.
Welcome to The Right Question, a program that features writers from the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with David Abrams, who's the author of Fobbit. It's a novel that grew out of journal entries he wrote while he was in the Army, stationed in Iraq. Beyond the literal definition of Fobbit, is your definition, which you write out very eloquently in the first paragraphs of the book. Do you mind just reading them?
Sure, I'd love to. They were fobbits because, at the core, they were nothing but marshmallow. Crack open their chests, and in the space where their hearts should be beating with a warrior's courage and selfless regard, you'd find a pale, gooey center. They cowered like rabbits in their cubicles, busied themselves with PowerPoint briefings to avoid the hazard of Baghdad's bombs, and steadfastly clung white-knuckled to their desks at forward operating base Triumph. If the fob was a mother's skirt, then these soldiers were pressed hard against the pleats, too scared to venture beyond her grasp. Like the shy, hairy-footed hobbits of Tolkien's world, they were reluctant to go beyond their shire, bristling with rolls of concertina wire at the borders of the fob. After all, there were goblins in turbans out there. Or so they convinced themselves. Supply clerks, motor pool mechanics, cooks, mail sorters, lawyers, trombone players, logisticians, fobbits one and all. They didn't give a shit about appearances. They were all about making it out of Iraq in one piece. Of all the fobbits in the U.S. Military Task Force headquarters at the western edge of Baghdad, Staff Sergeant Chance Gooding Jr. was the fobbitiest. With his neat-pressed uniform, his lavender vanilla body wash, and the dust collected around the barrel of his M16 rifle, he was the poster child for the stay back, stay safe soldier. The smell of something sweet radiated off his skin, as if he bathed in gingerbread.
Your novel has been compared to Slaughterhouse-5 and Catch-22, which is very high praise. What prompted you to turn your fobbity experiences into a novel?
To backtrack just a little bit, I was an active duty soldier for 20 years, a career public affairs soldier myself. And in 2004, I was assigned to the 3rd Infantry Division, which is out of Fort Stewart, Georgia. And then I came down on orders to deploy to in support of Operation Iraqi Freedom. So in 2005, I went over to Iraq, and this was my first time in a combat zone. So I was the model citizen to be a fobbit, someone who does kind of cower back in the cubicles, and I didn't know what to expect at the time. So it was a kind of a big, scary world, or so I thought at the time. I knew when I went over there, and this was my first time going into combat. So I knew when I went over there that I would need to capture all the details of combat life with the assumption that I might get a book or something out of it, or story at least. So I kept a journal, and I kept a daily journal, wrote in it every day for, you know, a couple hours after work. And eventually, about halfway through the tour, I started getting the sense that there could be more to this than just another Iraq War memoir. I wanted to do something a little bit different, and I've always leaned towards fiction. So I think when I started seeing some of the absurdities around me, I think that's when I got the idea that it can be something funny or a little bit off kilter, maybe. And that's when I started directing the attention and focus towards it being a novel.
What's the ratio of fact to fiction here? I mean, do you have men in dark coats lurking outside your house now? Or
well, God, I hope not. You know, it's been, you know, it's taken me 6 years basically to write this, Cherie, and it's gone through so many different iterations in my mind and on the page that it's hard for me to tell what's fact and fiction anymore. Sometimes I actually have to go back to my journal entries and say and find out if what I had on the page actually did happen or a version of it. Nothing in the book is directly factual except for the very historic event of the stampede on the bridge across the, I think it's the Tigris River. That's obviously based on a historic event, but most everything else starts in truth and then spins out from there into my imagination.
So when you go to work for the Army in communications, you don't have to sign anything that says you won't write about them.
You know, as we've seen with the latest SEAL book, yes. You obviously don't want to divulge any classified information or things like that. But I think I'm pretty safe with this book. There's nothing, I don't reveal anything classified. So it's a novel. It's a novel about men at war, a little bit different kind of war.
Except that if this is really how the Army communication is run, then it's scary.
Well, I think there's, like I said, a little bit of truth to it, but for the most part, it's pretty much a cartoon of how things are. Did I have my challenges while I was over there and faced the same kind of things that Staff Sergeant Gooding did? Sure. Did I have to have the press release go through multi layers of approval before it got sent out, and it was 5 or 6 hours after the fact of the incident? Sure, that happened. You know, I definitely turned the volume up all the way to 11, maybe even 12.
Yeah, and in the meantime, while you're going through all those drafts, CNN has it already splattered all over the world.
Oh, exactly. I think that's kind of when I started getting a little frustrated maybe with the job and even just a tad cynical. And so that's kind of when my mood shifted in terms of what I thought might come out of here, mm-hmm. or out of my experience and onto the page.
Well, back to Gooding. Tell us who he is and describe his job in Iraq.
Staff Sergeant Chance Gooding Jr. is a non-commissioned officer in the Army, and he serves as a public affairs NCO with the fictional 7th Armored Division. And his job is to take press releases based on the significant activity reports that he gets that come across the wire from the intel there at his headquarters. And he works in a task force headquarters there in Baghdad. He works in one of Saddam Hussein's old marbled palaces. And his job is to take all of the sometimes gory atrocities that happen and sometimes just run-of-the-mill incidents and turn those into press releases with 3 or 4 sentences that basically capture the nugget of the information that the Army wants to get out to the American public or the world. Then he distributes those press releases to the media. But it can be a laborious process along the way.
While U.S. soldiers are out fighting with weapons, Fobbits like Gooding are battling for control of the media, which seems like a futile battle, as we just talked about, because in the age of embedded journalists and instantly mobilized CNN camera crews, this process of putting out a press release is really antiquated.
You know, it really is, and I don't want to criticize the Army too much, but they are sometimes slow to pick up on the way that they should be doing things. They're definitely getting better. As the internet era that we live in tends to ramp up and accelerate at an exponential pace, then the Army public affairs especially is forced to keep up with with that pace. So they are changing the way they do business. I mean, if you look at the Army Public Affairs now, as opposed to Army Public Affairs during the Vietnam War era, there's a massive amount of difference in the way that information is gathered and distributed, and in terms of how Army officers and soldiers relate to the media as well. So.
And also, I think in the way soldiers relate with people back home, because they used to have their letters go through a censor and get things blacked out, and now they send emails.
Right, and then, of course, you also have Skype, which is, you know, instant visual. So, yeah, I mean, when I was over in Baghdad in 2005, things were just starting to change. I didn't have a cell phone. I knew some soldiers that did. I didn't have an internet connection in my trailer, in my hooch, but there was an internet cafe that we would all go to after work, or sometimes some people would sneak away from work to go shoot emails back to their wives. And of course, soldiers kept blogs while they were over there too. So that was something, that was a challenge that the Army had to deal with. And those were the kind of things that were just starting when I was over there, or kind of in its infancy when I was over there. So
the censors would have a really hard time.
I think it's you know, pushing a rock uphill, frankly. So,
well, there's an avalanche of acronyms in the story, consistent with military jargon, and one in particular is important to Gooding's daily life, and that is SMOG. One of the sentences that I really liked went like this: "All SIGACs were filtered through SMOG and recorded in the system's deep, wide database." So tell us about SMOG.
Well, SMOG is something that I created. It was very loosely based on an actual system that we had over there where we could connect all of the different FOBs and camps and outlying Army posts and military installations over there in Baghdad. And so we could all be connected and all sit around at our computers. It's basically like one big giant conference call. And they would have update briefings to the commanding general twice a day. And that's when you'd see all these staff officers huddled around their computer terminals. And it was kind of surreal. I mean, back in the old days, you would have the briefing officer stand at the front of a room, and everybody would be in rows of chairs. And everybody would have to stop what they were doing, where they were doing, come into that central location to the briefing tent, and then go through the briefing and then go back out. So it was a lot slower, more laborious process. So in one respect, it's great to have that internet and computer connectivity. But SMOG, yes, SMOG stands for the Secure Military Operations Grid, and it's something completely fabricated by David Abrams.
Who has a terrific imagination. It also seems like you had a lot of fun naming your characters.
Charles Dickens is, of course, one of my lampposts, one of my heroes. And so I think the kind of off-kilter and funky names that I gave my characters are sort of an homage to his work with his characters. He was another writer who was able to take something that was pretty grim and, you know, sober and serious subject of poverty and economic depression and corruption in the legal system, and he can spin it around and make it something pretty funny and fairly palatable to his readers.
Colonel Belcher comes to mind.
Yes, Colonel Belcher, and there's several others that are sort of Dickensian. So I had a lot of fun with these characters in the story.
I could tell. For example, two characters who were loosely connected, Captain Abe Schrinkle and Mrs. Norma Tingledecker. You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with David Abrams about his novel, Fobbit. After a short break, he'll read a passage that features Captain Schrinkle and Mrs. Tingledecker. Stay tuned.
So here in chapter 14, we're talking about Captain Abe Shrinkle, who is a company commander of soldiers who are in the 7th Armored Division. Shrinkle had earned a reputation around the FOB as the care package king. It started with a trickle of boxes from his mother, her friends at work, and a few of his online friends, those who posted regularly to the American Civil War reenactors group at northvsouth.net. Then Shrinkle had learned that there was a multitude of organizations back in the United States, mothers of deployed soldiers, mothers of dead soldiers, prayer circles at churches, Girl Scout troops, Harley-Davidson Vietnam clubs, the Vermont Republican Purple Ladies, you name it. And they had all made a nonprofit cottage industry of collecting items that would, quote, bring the comfort of home, unquote, to our men and women who have placed themselves in harm's way. Most Americans had no concept of what it meant to live in a world of car bombs and mortar threats and severed arms cocked in the grass beside the road. But, Abe was certain, most of them wanted to know. They wanted to empathize with him and his soldiers, and they felt slack and helpless sitting back there in the land of cheeseburgers and Paris Hilton perfume. They wanted to say or do something, so they reached out a hand in the airport, or they mailed a package of chocolate chip cookies to a person they would never meet. And still they knew it wasn't enough, but at least it was something. And so, across America, but especially in the central belt of the heartland, men and women, boys and girls, young and old, armed with plastic baggies and black markers, formed assembly lines and packed boxes full of donations that had flooded into the collection center. They spent hours upon hours each week, carefully nesting baked goods and toiletries into boxes, bound for soldiers they didn't know from Adam or Eve. They pulled the names off the websites they'd built, which allowed soldiers to sign up to be on the receiving end. It gave these mothers and fathers, these teachers and students, these pastors and their flocks, hot butterflies of happiness inside their chests. And though they didn't truly understand what was going on over in Iraq, and really had no idea what it was like to wear 80 pounds of body armor in the 120-degree heat, it helped salve their collective guilt over the way America had treated the boys returning from Vietnam. Along with the yellow ribbon stickers on the backs of their cars, it was a way for them to show the rest of the world, Democrats especially, they really knew how to support the troops. It was incredible how the screech of pulling tape across the flaps of just one box could bring spiritual harmony to a person, make her feel like that she was doing something that mattered. Once Captain Abe Shrinkle stumbled across this network of do-gooders, there was no stopping him. In truth, he was supposed to share what he got with the rest of his company, but he'd always been a hoarder, and this just fed his hunger, like grabbing an addict by the hair, tipping back his head, and pouring baggies of cocaine into his nostrils. Abe keeps to himself, spending most of his time in the trailer, arranging the various contents of his care packages, and whiling away the remainder of his time reading the W.E.B. Griffin paperbacks that arrive with predictable regularity. On this day, 2 days after Abe accidentally killed a local national by roasting the body beneath a truck, most of the boxes contained the usual assortment of granola bars, mixed nuts, hand sanitizer, and magazines, Muscle and Fitness, Vermont Life, GQ, etc. The encyclopedia weight package turns out to be a year's supply of shampoo and conditioner, along with 3 oily fruitcakes in Ziploc baggies. One thick envelope, however, is from a woman in Laramie, Wyoming, an oil man's wife who fancies herself something of a poet. She has written to Abe several times, and he's answered promptly and enthusiastically, their correspondence revolving around Wyoming geology and literature and the joys and frustrations of being an unpublished poet trapped in a loveless marriage. In this day's envelope, Mrs. Norma Tingledecker has included 2 packages of jerky made from genuine Cheyenne beef, along with another epistle, handwritten in lavender ink, about her Bluebird soundtracked life on the high plains. Abe sits there and snacks on the Wyoming cows as he reads the 2-page letter she's enclosed. Wyoming got its typical Father's Day snow last week, in the north. But down here in Laramie, it's all burning blue skies and the golden tumble of leaves from the aspen and cottonwoods when the wind shakes the boughs. I saw a tiny warbler in the juniper bush outside my window 2 days ago. She's on her way south, confused by the unseasonal snow, perhaps. The fishing, too, is magnificent. mostly because of what you can see and smell and hear when you're standing in the middle of the warmish, slow-moving Platte River. Mint, dew-frosted sage, the trilly scoldings of kingfishers and ravens, the careful sip of a rainbow trout. And in the fall, the farewell serenade of Canada geese, which breaks one's heart with the reminder of seasons. I feel blessed every day to live in a place where nature still has the upper hand. Ah, if only I felt the same glorious surge of love for my husband, Ray. He's a stinking, no-good bastard who always finds it necessary to stop at the Rockin' R before he sloppy stumbles his way home to an ice-cold dinner. Oh, but don't get me started. No doubt you already have too much to fret away at your nerves and occupy your mind over there for me to be going on about Ray. Abe clutches at her words. He doesn't want to leave this letter and the sensory images it conjures. A place where nature still has the upper hand. Yes, yes, yes. He wants to go there so desperately, right now, it nearly doubles him over in pain. He rolls the jerky on his tongue, savoring it as long as he can. He sighs. No, I must remain here in a land where evil has the upper hand. It is my duty and proud obligation. He carefully refolds Norma Tingledecker's letter, tucks it back into its lavender-scented envelope, and turns to the next box, ripping away the tape, which resists with an angry squeal. More socks. Abe doesn't have enough feet for all the socks he's received since February.
The term moneymaker has a special significance in Gooding's world, and in Chapter 17, it refers to specialist Kyle Pilley. So tell us why he was labeled a moneymaker, about this concept of a moneymaker.
Well, the concept of a moneymaker is one I sort of generated, but it was kind of informally used, I think, over there. It's a slang term for a soldier or a situation that the public affairs officers think will really get a good bang for their buck in the American media. For instance, you have your Jessica Lynch's and your Pat Tillman's until that went south and sour. But in the book's case, you have Kyle Pilley, who is a specialist, and he was out on the streets one day pulling a regular guard duty patrol there, and he was shot by a sniper. The bullet fortunately ricocheted off of his flak vest. He fell down, but then he bounced right back up. And long story short, he and his partner went after the snipers who had shot at them, captured them, and they were sort of minor heroes for the day. So the public affairs officers in Task Force Baghdad, they see this as an opportunity. They want to seize this opportunity to get him on all the talk shows like Good Morning America, on the cover of Time and Newsweek, and all of those sorts of things. So they have high hopes for Kyle Pilley to be a model American soldier, the face of the Iraq War.
One of the blurbs on the back of the book was written by Thomas McGuane, and he writes, "This delightful, readable, believable, and useful book made me furious." And I have to say, it made me furious, too, just because I know that you, as you say, you've amped this up to a 10 or 11 for the comedic aspect in your novel. But it's based on things that are really happening.
I think comedy, whether it's good or bad comedy, I think comedy has at its heart the truth. And that's what makes it funny. We wouldn't be laughing at some of the things that happen in the book if there weren't something that we at least perceived was going on in Iraq and Afghanistan. So I guess that's my goal to make a situation comedic, but yet also truthful at the same time.
Well, it calls attention to the situation.
It does. Yeah, it really does.
One of the other disturbing things was the approach of the number 2,000 when there were going to be 2,000 men killed, and there was all this churning in Fobbit land about who that would be and how they could spin the story. And Gooding makes an entry into his diary that I'd like you to read.
I should also point out this actually, we dealt with the number 2000 while I was over there. So that was, so that's pretty close to what I wrote in my journal. So.
Oh my God.
Yeah. From the diary of Chance Gooding Jr. 1,996. For those of you marking your scorecards at home, that's the tally of Operation Iraqi Freedom as of right now, this instant, this nanosecond, before the next bomb is detonated, before the next grubby thumb presses the remote-controlled cell phone trigger, or the next zealous Muslim chanting Allahu Akbar steers his car bomb towards a U.S. convoy, and some unlucky soldier bites the bullet, dubiously privileged with his 15 minutes of fame as number 2,000. Ah, but that's four bodies down the road. For now, the score hovers at 1,996. Better mark it in pencil, though, and have an eraser handy. The media are drawn like jackals to a watering hole by the number 2,000. These sharp-fanged, saliva-lipped members of the Fourth Estate claim it's a milestone, one to be marked with a top-of-the-fold story. They love the sensuous curve of the two and the plump satisfaction of those triple zeros lined up like perfect bullet holes. Bam, bam, bam. 2,000 is a number most Americans can hold in their minds and use it to remember the awful waste of this war, this overlong field trip to the desert where we got ourselves tangled in a briar patch and stuck to the tar baby of terrorism.
An eloquent fobbit.
Who'd have thunk it? A poet on the battlefield.
David Abrams lives in Butte, Montana. Look for more information about him and his novel at therightquestion.blogspot.com. Be sure to spell right with a W. You'll also find links there to our Facebook page and podcast.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau, Lisa Simon, David Moore, and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. Music for this program was written and performed by John Floridis. You'll find links to author information, audio, and our Facebook and podcast feeds at therightquestion.blogspot.com. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.